We are here with State Senator Scott Herndon, who is seeking re-election for Idaho Legislative District 1 State Senate. He will be on the ballot in the Republican primary on May 21st. And thank you for speaking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Let's start with an introduction to you for the voters. Tell us a bit about your background and how you wound up in North Idaho.
So this month, we've been here 20 years. In May of 2004, my wife and I found a house here in Sandpoint. And in June of 2004, we found some land down in Sagal and built our house in 05. We had a daughter born here in Sandpoint before we sold the house here that was on South Division Street. And then for years, I was a Bonner County jail chaplain here from 08 to 2013, and really didn't get involved in politics at all until about 2018 is when I figured out that the local Republican Party existed and that there's things that you can do and that you can actually impact the state and the Republican Party. And so I've been active in the party since 18. I went to the Republican Party convention, which was down south. And in 2020, I actually joined the local Republican Party as a precinct committeeman and became the chair of the Bonner County Republican Party sometime after that because our chair moved to Missouri. And then I ran for the state senate in 2022, and that's what I've been doing for two sessions now down in Boise. And my wife and I still live on that same piece of land we bought back in 2004, so we're pretty happy, never plan to move anywhere.
What's your background as far as education and what you do outside of elected office and things like that?
Okay, So I actually grew up in Sacramento, California in the 1970s, back when California was a lot different than it is today. And then I went to Missouri Military Academy for high school because I wanted a better option than at the time I was in Elk Grove, and Elk Grove High School was really big, and I was concerned I wanted a smaller school. So went to Missouri Military Academy, ended up studying finance at Arizona State University, graduated in 1989 with a degree in finance. And I actually worked in accounting, finance, and I was a PeopleSoft financials system installer for years. When I moved here and after I built my house, I basically did home building, and that's what I've been doing for 18 years. I basically just build one house a year for usually a custom home for a couple on a big piece of property rurally, and we just move from job to job, have a couple guys that work for me and employ subcontractors, and they're usually pretty decent custom homes.
And now you are seeking re-election in... Briefly, why are you running for re-election?
Well, we're at a crossroads in the state. I think we saw some progress during the last election cycle. A lot of people think of Idaho as Republican, as red. A lot of people that have lived here a long time, moved here recently. Decades ago, everything north of Lewiston, all the representatives were Democrats, but that's when the Democrats were a lot more conservative, more like in the line of a Kennedy Democrat. And then everything kind of switched to Republican. So a lot of people that have moved here in the last several decades think of Idaho as red and Republican. But what they don't realize is that when Idaho is rated against other states, and I mean the state legislatures, it turns out Idaho really isn't that conservative. We usually rank in the bottom 10 among the 50 states as to how conservative our policies are. Are we conservative fiscally? And we made some progress on that during the last election cycle. We've got a beachhead that's moved the ball a little bit more to the right of center, just slightly. And that's the precarious balance that's at stake in this election, is that we want to improve our fiscal conservatism. We are spending $2 billion of national debt in the state budget every year. And we want to be a leader in conservative legislation, not be a follower. So when we look at states like Louisiana, Texas, Florida, that are solving real problems that voters care about, we want to lead and not just wait and be one of the last red states to take a leadership role. So I think that's what's at stake in the election.
The legislature typically is in session from January through at least March. This year concluded on April 10th. But it is, you're elected for a year-round position. So how do you usually spend your time outside of the active legislative session, you know, about how much time on, like, let's say, a weekly basis?
Well, definitely takes a number of hours every week throughout the year. So when you're in session, it's a full-time job. I fly down to Boise on Sunday night, fly back on Friday night. I'm on the budget committee, so we start in the 7 a.m. hour, and I spend 16-hour days while I'm there for those 3 months that we're down there. During the rest of the year, of course, I'm trying to make a living and spend some time with my family because I'm not doing that when I'm down in Boise. However, it does take a number of hours a week. I'll typically get a lot of phone calls, several a week, some emails, and people want to pursue solutions to different problems they're having. It could be really simple, like a lady called me from up near Priest Lake, and she said there was a concern about Highway 57, and there's a turnout there with some forced service markings, and she was concerned that the speeds were too fast through there. And when she called me, I asked her to email me so that I'd have her contact information. Then I contacted ITD, and they sent up a crew the next day, and they actually put in new signage. And then and that was last fall, and she recently contacted me and said that she'd like to maybe have them take a look at it again and add some lighting to the signage and still study whether to slow the speeds. So I'll be following up with her in that. And I get a lot of calls like that. I'll get recently, we've gotten a lot of emails about chemtrails and geoengineering. And so then all of a sudden you have to do a lot of study about subjects that you may not necessarily know a lot about, but that people in the district care about it. And you want to be of service to them. And if there's a legislative solution, then we propose legislative solutions. And we study and do that over the summer and the fall, because you don't want to wait until you're in the legislative session to devise solutions for people's problems.
What do you consider the biggest issues in this upcoming, well, the ongoing Senate race that you would like the voters to consider?
Well, number one is spending, because I think that's what affects people at the kitchen table. It's how much food can you afford if you're building a project? How much lumber can you buy for $1,000 versus what you were able to buy it for 4 years ago? What amount in taxes are you paying? And how valuable is your dollar? And I think everybody understands pain at the pump and rising gas costs, and they understand increasing property taxes. And so those are things that get on the state legislature's agenda. And what people don't realize is that the legislature looks at a projection of how much tax revenue and fees and how much money they're going to get from the federal government. And this year it was about $13.8 billion. And a lot of the way the legislature does their budgeting is they'll say, well, we've got $13.8 billion projected in the next year, so let's go ahead and break that up into pieces and spend it all. And that's not the way I look at it. I look at it as, should we spend the entire $13.8, or can we put more money back in the taxpayers' pockets? And understand that in that $13.8 billion, $2 billion of that is federal debt, national debt. It's not taxes that we paid. It's money that the federal government has printed, created out of thin air, or borrowed. And so that's decreasing the value of our dollar. I think that's one of the most critical issues Idaho faces, because the whole nation is now $35 trillion in debt, and we add $1 trillion to the national debt every 100 to 120 days. And I think that's one of the most critical issues that we face.
The Idaho legislature concluded its 2024 session last month. What kind of grade... I won't ask you to grade yourself, but how about the legislature overall? Like, how do you think the legislature this session did, and why?
I think we got a lot done this year. We could have done more, but I think it's pretty acceptable what was accomplished. I think we funded a lot of things that needed to be funded. So critical infrastructure got funded. Transportation, education, school facilities through House Bill 521. We created $1 billion worth of bonding, which is the state's going to borrow money. And then the local school districts are going to be able to use that to improve or build new facilities. I think that was critical. And I think the legislature scored a good grade on that. The other things that we took on this year, and these are some of the actual really important issues, because I just talked to a person who lives here, who just moved here from New Mexico, and she said with the illegal immigration, and I just talked to someone last month about Arizona, about the illegal immigration in Arizona and what that has done to the crime rates in those states and what it's put, the burden it's put on social services and the public welfare. And we have the same problem here in Idaho, and I think we made a little progress against that this year. There's a push in southern Idaho where we have a lot of agriculture and a lot of illegal immigrants are working in the agricultural industry, and there's a push from the agricultural industry, particularly the dairymen, want us to make a path for legal status for illegal immigrants. And I've pushed back on them and said, we cannot do that because that's jurisdiction of the federal government. I think we managed to hold the line there and make a few advances, but I can talk about, and even in that arena, legislation that succeeded and legislation that failed. Like, we could not get a bill where the governor could enter into border compact with neighbor states to go down and secure the southern border if the federal government refuses to do that. That was House Bill 464. It passed the House, and we couldn't get it a hearing in the Senate. So we're making some progress, but we're not getting everything across the finish line.
I'm going to ask about some specific bills. You already mentioned House Bill 521, which, as you mentioned, Idaho will spend an additional $1.5 billion over the next decade to help fund building construction and maintenance for schools around the state. You voted in favor of this bill. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to say that you didn't already say about 521? Why do you support it?
It had a lot of good things to like. Number one, yeah, it did address the school facilities issue, probably not thoroughly, but pretty close. It covered a lot of what's needed around the state. There's a great question about whether it got distributed to the right areas in the right proportion. That's always going to be a debate in the legislature. It's one of those debates that's almost impossible to solve because every place in the state's different, one from another, and the needs are different, one from another. But what else is in that bill is that we blocked diversity statements, basically things that are going on in hiring practices in schools that weren't fair to everybody, and that was in the bill. We actually also removed an election date in the bill. That was the August election date last year in the property tax bill. We removed the March election date so that now when we have elections, we're talking about May and November when more voters participate. And I think that's appropriate when we're talking about those elections usually involving adding taxes to our citizens. And so those were a few of the things to like in that bill. It wasn't a perfect bill, and we ended up passing a trailer behind it to fix some of the appropriations that are coming out in that facilities money. But I think it was good progress in that bill.
Mm. Let's talk about House Bill 415, which did not make it out of the state Senate State Affairs Committee, but it did pass the House, and that was the bill to allow public school employees with concealed weapons permits to bring concealed firearms to school grounds. There was a follow-up in the Senate, 1418, I believe, which would have replaced the House bill allowing local entities to impose stricter firearm training requirements if they choose to, but ultimately these bills didn't make it out of the Senate State Affairs Committee. Would you have favored or opposed these bills?
I opposed Senate Bill 1418 because it was over-regulative and in reality would have made it harder for teachers to have firearms in school facilities. And I supported House Bill 415 because a concealed carry permit, most people don't realize this. We get this concern at the legislature all the time. We'll have a bill like House Bill 415, and people will say, well, I don't want people with guns around me. And I always point out that there are people with guns around you. Idaho has a very high gun ownership rate. We have constitutional carry. You don't even need a concealed carry permit to carry a firearm concealed here. And if you go to your typical grocery store or your typical farmer's market or your typical art in the park, which they mention a lot down in Boise, you're probably standing right next to someone who's carrying a firearm. And they are the first responders. And I recommend people get trained, but I think the concealed carry license has a lot of good training that comes with it. And I'd rather see if you're living in a rural area and it takes 40 minutes for a first responder to get to the school, I want to see some first responders that are there within seconds and have tools on them that can mitigate a threat from an active shooter. And I think that's one way to do it. And I would have supported House Bill 415 if it got to the floor.
Mm-hmm. On private militias, Senate Bill 1240 would eliminate Idaho's prohibition on private militias. Also didn't make it out of the Senate State Affairs Committee. Do you have take on the Bill 1240?
I'm pretty sure that one made it out and didn't get out of the House Transportation and Defense Committee. And I was, so that passed the Senate overwhelmingly this year and another version of it very similar last year. And I was a co-sponsor on the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is, if you look at the United States history and the idea of what a militia is, the militia is not meant to be the National Guard. The National Guard is more like our federalized version of aid and assistance. If you go back to the Civil War, the states would put up troops to fight in the Civil War, and those would be state-organized militias. But the and that's what the National Guard is today. An actual militia under our founders' doctrine and their writings was more of a locally organized militia, and that's really what the intent of Senate Bill 1240 was to accomplish, is to return us to the original definition of a militia, and I still support the concept.
Let's see here. How about the initiative process? There was a proposed House Bill 652, which would have created a public review period of the signatures submitted for initiative petition, allowing more voters time to change their minds about signing a petition and require monthly updates on signature gathering. The House passed the bill, but it did not progress out of the Senate State Affairs Committee. Did you favor or oppose that legislation?
I would have supported that legislation. Yeah. The main reason is I think it's reasonable when you've got an initiative process going. We have a multi-step process for initiative. Is just the citizens making legislation, just like the legislature makes a lot of legislation. We voted on 350 bills this year. And there's a multiple-step process, and sometimes a bill will look good when it's on one side of the House, or that could be the House or the Senate, so on one side of the rotunda, and it looks good in committee, and it gets to the floor, and it still looks good. And if you give it enough time, all of a sudden someone points out that there's a problem with the bill. Great example, last year, House Bill 25 easily passed the House, and it was what we call one of the hostage bills. They were holding it toward the end to get leverage to get some other bills passed on the other side of the rotunda. So we had it in the Senate, House Bill 25, easily passed the House. A couple months go by. We get it on the Senate floor. I looked at it and noticed some constitutional concerns. So even though it had passed committees, two committees, and a body of the legislature, we realized it had major problems at the fourth stage of the process. And so in our debate on the Senate floor, we ended up pulling the bill, amending it, and passing an improved version. So I think always taking more time, having more eyeballs on it, makes for better legislation, works in the legislature, and works in the ballot initiative process.
There is one ballot initiative that will likely be on the ballot in November. That's the Open Primaries Initiative. It's not before the legislature itself, so you'll just be voting on it as a private citizen, but it would end Idaho's closed Republican primary so that all voters, regardless of party affiliation, can vote in the primary election. Would also allow voters to rank candidates in order of preference. Do you have an opinion on the Open Primaries initiative?
It's a terrible idea, and I also think that the ballot initiative circulators are being deceptive by calling it open primaries, because it's not. We used to have open primaries in Idaho, and the Idaho Supreme Court said that open primaries violate the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which is why we don't have them now. Parties have a right to affiliate and choose their own nominees. This doesn't make an open primary. Right now, everybody can participate. They just have to affiliate with a party. And then depending on the rules for that party, they can vote in their primary election. So the Republicans say you've got to be affiliated Republican to vote in our primary election, which is picking our standard bearer, our nominees. I think that's a fair process. What this does is it gets rid of political parties altogether, in essence, and it just says we don't really care what your political party is. We're going to have a top four primary. That's what it actually is. So it's not an open primary. It's top four. It eliminates all party primaries and makes one primary election where the top four vote getters advance to the general election. In my opinion, we normally don't even have four people running for any one of these particular offices in the general, regardless of party. And so if we were going to pass this, we might as well eliminate the primary election in May altogether and just have a general election, according to this theory and philosophy. But also, ranked choice voting is a terrible idea. And we only need to look at Alaska to see how that's turned out. You had 65% of voters in Alaska wanted a Republican to be their representative in the United States Congress. They had two Republicans run and one Democrat, and the Democrat won that race because of ranked choice voting. And now Alaska's got it on their ballot this November to reverse ranked choice voting. Everywhere that's implemented, California cities that have implemented it find that if you like parties, it's not a good idea. You never get the results that you want. So I'm going to, it turns out in a Boise State University public policy survey, ranked choice voting polls in the 24-27% range of public approval. So I think the focus ought to be on the fact that this ballot initiative is a ranked choice voting ballot initiative. And I don't think Democrats or Republicans are going to like it in the long run.
Well, the harmful library materials bill was another controversial issue this year. House Bill 710 passed and was signed by the governor, so is now in effect. This is the one that allows children or their parents to sue librarians for $250 plus other possible damages after they provide 60 days written notice to a library asking them to move a book to an adults only section. You voted in favor of this bill, correct?
Yeah. I did.
Yeah. Do you consider this a settled issue at this point, or do we expect further legislation around the materials in public libraries to come?
No, I believe that this is a settled issue. I think it makes complete sense. We passed a great bill that I helped draft, House Bill 498, which deals with online porn distribution, and I'll bring this up because it compares to the library bill, in my opinion. All of the Democrats and all of the Republicans voted for House Bill 498. The governor, in his signing of House Bill 498, which requires age verification for online porn distributors to distribute porn, and they cannot give porn, and I mean material harmful to minors, that it's a crime today in Idaho Code, and it was a crime 10 years ago and 40 years ago, to give this particular definition of materials to a kid, unless you're a school or library. That material right now will, as of July 1st, will be outlawed online. And Pornhub is probably going to pull out of the state like they did in Louisiana and Texas. So the Democrats love this bill, and the Republicans love the bill. And the governor issued a transmittal letter saying he loved House Bill 498. House Bill 710, the library bill, is the same material, the same definition, same material. And it just says we want an age verification filter for that material at government-run, taxpayer-funded public libraries. We don't want you giving that same material to kids at those libraries. So I think it's entirely consistent. And I honestly believe the Democrats should have voted for the bill as well. And if it's not a problem, it's not going to change anything at our libraries. But I like the bill.
Let's Senate Bill 1374, you proposed and passed. It has been signed into law. It blocks lessees of public property from banning concealed weapons unless they are renting the property for a private event by invitation only or for a commercial event that charges admission. So obviously you were in favor of this bill. What effects do you expect to see from the legislation?
Well, what it'll do is this follows up my lawsuit against the city of Sandpoint, which taxpayers didn't pay anything for. That's, by the way, incorrect information. My lawsuit, Herndon versus Sandpoint, we paid all the fees of the city, the festival, and my side. And that lawsuit was based on the premise that if we were in Georgia and you had public property and a group rented it for a concert or a farmer's market or a short duration, if you're in Georgia, the Georgia Supreme Court says that it doesn't become private property for that event. And you can't ban firearm carry at that event. But we're not in Georgia. We're in Idaho. And Idaho law is not as deep as Georgia's law. We don't have the legislative history as Georgia. We haven't been around as long. And we haven't ever had this situation come up until the festival. So when we sued over the festival on the premise that we believe that publicly funded taxpayer-owned property, you should be able to carry your firearm, the Supreme Court of Idaho said, actually, we don't have any statutes on that subject. And so they went to the common law and said that taxpayer-funded public property, even if it's rented, permitted, contracted, or leased for an hour, becomes private property during that hour or during the time of that contract or permit. And thereby, the person renting it can ban people from coming onto the property and ban anything that they bring with them. And so Senate Bill 1374 just said, well, with that opinion from the Supreme Court, downtown farmers markets in Boise, Sandpoint, Moscow, a private farmers market renting a city park, Art in the Park in Boise, for example, could ban firearms at their event under that Supreme Court opinion. So basically, this is covering the potentialities that the Supreme Court opinion opened up and says, no, that's not going to be the case. You have to have restricted access to the public property in order to ban firearms as well.
Mm. The legislature weighed well over 100 bills this year. Are there other, bearing in mind we're already about 25 minutes into the conversation here, any other specific bills you want to mention as supporting or opposing that come to mind?
I was surprised on House Bill 615, which would basically take away welfare benefits from illegal immigrants, all welfare, all public welfare, from illegal aliens, people who are here in the state, except for emergency services, emergency medical services. I was surprised that that didn't get out of a House committee. I think that's a very reasonable approach to dealing with the cost of public services for people who are not lawfully in the country, give them the services they need. And so I'd like to see that kind of legislation advance in the future. And then I would like to continue to see some budget progress. So we completely changed the budget process this year because we got a lot more fiscally responsible. We broke our budgets out into two parts where we fund the base of the agency. So, for example, I voted for a bill, Senate Bill 1266, to fund the Department of Corrections, the Idaho State Police. But then if they want to spend new money, new line items, we get to take a separate vote on those line items, which is a great way to do budgeting. Ronald Reagan always argued for the line item veto. And essentially, we implemented that at the legislative level. That was a huge victory this year in the legislature. I'm pleased to see that, and I'm pleased to see that progress move forward.
Mm. Moving now to kind of wrapping up, just a few closing questions. You have said, and your opponent, I believe, would agree, that there is a fundamental difference in philosophy regarding the role of the state. So in your view, what is the proper role of state government?
Well, I don't think we should look for state government to solve all of our problems. Ronald Reagan said the worst thing you can have happen is the government knocks on your door and says, I'm the government and I'm here to solve your problems. Government, because it has no competition, doesn't solve every problem very efficiently. But the way things work in Boise is while we're all here working to make a living and doing our business, there are lobbyists paid by major corporations down in Boise. And I'll give an example. Bayer is one of them. And Bayer had a bill this year. They gave all of House and Senate leadership donations at the beginning of January. And then Bayer bought Monsanto, and Monsanto has been buried in Roundup lawsuits for a long time. And Monsanto was the most hated corporation in America. And Bayer wanted the Idaho legislature to pass a bill to keep Monsanto Roundup lawsuits from proceeding here in Idaho, would block them. And they paid lobbyists to come and try to get this bill passed. They gave donations to House and Senate leadership. And I help hold the line against that. But that's the fight, is people want to use government to benefit themselves. Corporations do, typically, through lobbyists that are there full-time, 100% of the time that we're down there. And we need people down there who want to keep government out of our lives. The courts are meant to go toe-to-toe with companies like Bayer. So we shouldn't be using government to benefit major corporations. We should use government to protect the God-given and constitutional rights of regular people. And that's really what the purpose of government is for.
How do you see the state of Idaho as currently governed, you know, aligning with that, with your kind of philosophy of the proper role of state government?
We could do better. It's not terrible, but it's been slowly drifting the wrong direction. And so you see a trajectory of government spending at the federal level, and that's why we're $35 trillion in debt. And that's why the Idaho government has grown its spending 54% in the last 5 years, from $9 billion to $13.8 billion. And we held the line on spending growth this year, thankfully. That direction says that government is doing too much. It isn't just the cost of the rate of growth of the state and inflation. That exceeds the rate of the growth of the state and inflation. It includes more governmental services and more things the government is doing. So I think it's not the worst state in the nation, but it's not a sustainable direction for individual liberty.
we're nearing the end here, but we can't finish this conversation without mentioning abortion. You've been outspoken on the topic. How do you feel the current Idaho laws should be changed regarding abortion, if at all?
The Idaho Supreme Court issued an opinion in Planned Parenthood versus State on January 5th, 2023, concerning Idaho's current abortion law. 139 pages, they carefully explained how generous the law is in relation to what physicians are able to actually accomplish in legitimate medical care. And unfortunately, people have then tried to drive a political wedge on the issue. And the reality is Bonner General and other hospitals are not doing any abortions. And for 20 years, they haven't done any abortions. And we have a mandatory abortion reporting law. And so they tell me they're in full compliance with the law. And that really, if you look at the definition of criminal abortion, it doesn't include ectopic pregnancies. It doesn't include removing a dead baby. And all it says is that you got to try to save the life of both a baby and a mother if you have to give them emergency care. If you can't save the baby, you're not going to be held accountable. So I think the law works. It's the same law that we had in effect from 1863 to 1973. And some people will say, well, 1863, that was ancient. Well, look, 1973 wasn't. I was born before 1973. And Idaho was a thriving, growing state in 1973. And we had the same law in effect. So I don't want to see people drive a political wedge on the issue. I think we clarified the law last year in a way that is very clear, and I just think people are trying to weaponize it politically.
How will you respond if the U.S. Supreme Court finds against the state in the case that's currently before the Supreme Court? Or how do you anticipate a legislative response, I guess?
No, I don't think there will need to be one because it's a very narrow question that's before the United States Supreme Court related to EMTALA. And I think that the reality is there's no real conflict between EMTALA and the state of Idaho's abortion law. And I actually think regardless of whichever direction that decision goes, I don't think it's going to really necessitate a legislative response. I personally don't see a need to change the law in Idaho. I think we accomplished what we wanted, that we did not want elective abortions in the state of Idaho because we respect the right to life of every human being from womb to tomb. And I think that's what's in the Constitution of Idaho. First, it's Article 1, Section 1. And I think that's what the 14th Amendment says. And I think when we devalue any of our citizens and any human being, regardless of where they are, age, size, and ability, I think we're on a downward path that could affect all of us.
That's the last of my specific questions. So to just kind of to wrap up, I guess, what's your closing statement? What differentiates you as a candidate? Why should people vote for?
Well, the best summary of the race is the way I summarize it is Idaho's a uniparty state. 83% of the legislature right now is Republican. You can't win in these northern districts unless you're Republican. So the party differentiation isn't as valuable in these elections. And so it's really you have two guys running for the state Senate that have voting records. And the voting records are easily available on my website at herndon4idaho.com. I have, here's how I voted on a subject, and here's how the other guy voted on the same subject, with links back to the legislature's website. And when you look at the American Conservative Union and you look at the Institute for Legislative Analysis, these are all relatively conservative think tanks that are study legislatures nationwide. And I've got a rating north of 90%, and the other guy's got a rating south of 50%. And that shows you the difference. Idaho Ed News summed it up this week. IdahoEdNews.org said, look, you've got a challenge between an establishment Republican and a conservative Republican. And I think that's what the race comes down to. I'm the conservative Republican, and if people like fiscal conservatives, the other guy votes for every budget. I put a good change in line item veto reforms into the budget process. We're different on social issues, and our records are out there for people to analyze, and then they can make their choice. And like I say, I think I've laid out a pretty good analysis side by side of those records at my website. I encourage people to check that out and then vote for the candidate that best represents you.
That website is, well, yeah. How do people find out more if they're interested?
Mm-hmm. There you go. It is Herndon, HERNDON4idaho.com. And you'll see a comparison page between the two candidates in my race right there. And they can always call me if they have any questions, 208-610-2680. Always happy to take questions by text or phone call.
State Senator Scott Herndon running for re-election in Idaho Legislative District 1 on the ballot on May 21st. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Pleasure to be here. Appreciate the opportunity.